Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Senior Fellow and Chairman at the Institute. It's my pleasure today to be joined by Michael Maiden, who is Director of the China Energy Programme, and Agnieszka Assen, who is a Visiting Research Fellow, to discuss their joint paper, Force Majeure Notices from Chinese LNG Buyers, Prelude to a Renegotiation, that was published earlier this week. It's also, this podcast builds upon the podcast I recorded yesterday with Michal, which gives us the key messages coming out of the China program's China Day that they held at the end of February. Nice to have you guys. We've got a truly global podcast today. We've got Agnieszka in Kingston, Jamaica. Agnieszka, how are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right, actually. I think it's a bit warmer where you are than where I am. And how about you, Michal? You're in Northwest London.
I am indeed. All good here.
All good here. Excellent. Well, look, why don't we kick off with you, Michal? Can you just set the scene behind why Chinese companies would be wanting to declare a contractual force majeure on the oil, gas and LNG contracts at this particular time?
So the timing, I think, is really critical here. This comes as the coronavirus hits China. The government imposes travel restrictions and quarantines. And so there are logistical issues at the ports. Mm. They're working under capacity, some of the workers just can't get to the ports, and therefore they can't unload some of the cargoes.
Right.
At the same time, because of all these constraints, and it's the Chinese New Year, demand is weak, stocks are high, and so even if they could receive some of the cargoes, at least the claim is that they don't have anywhere to put it.
So
the question is this sort of a logistical issue, yeah, or is there something deeper behind it?
Absolutely. And that, of course, is the topic of the whole paper, which I would urge our listeners to read because it really is interesting, I have to say. So in the paper, you know, you say that in early February, CNOOC invoked force majeure on the cargoes. And this move was backed, I thought, interestingly, by force majeure certificates offered by the Chinese Council for the Promotion of International Trade. But, however, the notice was rejected by Total, Shell and Qatargas. So, Agnieszka, why don't we start with you by asking you to define what force majeure actually is?
Force majeure is a legal concept and a risk allocation mechanism in a contract which allows the party affected by force majeure to be excused from performance under that contract. There is no performance, but no breach of contract, and that can be a very useful mechanism to the affected party in difficult times. Now, LNG market participants, both buyers and sellers, have invoked force majeure on certain occasions and in response to earthquakes, hurricanes, mm-hmm. or civil unrest. What we are seeing now could be the first case of force majeure notice, which is filed specifically in response to an epidemic.
Well, okay, so therefore, you know, this leads to the obvious question, doesn't it? Were the Chinese company force majeure notices legal?
Oh, that's a very good question, which can be answered with full confidence only on the basis of the relevant contract. Generally, epidemic is listed as an example of a force majeure event under that contract. So it is likely there, but that's not the end of the story, and it does not yet offer an immediate relief. Many contracts stipulate certain circumstances which are excluded from the scope of force majeure. The most relevant example in our context will be loss of demand.
Right.
So if the loss of demand is the underlying cause, it is likely that the claim will be unsuccessful.
Interesting. But am I right in thinking, from my limited legal knowledge, that the force majeure party, i.e. the Chinese in this particular case, are required to mitigate before force majeure is called? And has this legal obligation been done?
Yeah, there are indeed certain steps which typically have to be fulfilled before the buyer can take the full advantage of the force majeure clause. Whether these steps were required to be undertaken by Chinese contracts, we don't know. But we have reports that indicate that cargo cancellations or rescheduling efforts have been made, and those actions can be seen in the context of mitigation efforts.
And also, again, my limited contractual knowledge, isn't there an obligation on the buyer after the event to use reasonable endeavours to take the LNG that was actually excused for any force majeure event in subsequent contract years in order to basically restore the overall contract volumes? Is that an obligation, do you think?
Yes, there is indeed such an obligation to take the shorter volumes at a later date under some contracts. Some other contracts will apply a different solution. They will allow the seller to sell LNG for the duration of the force majeure event. And if the LNG lands on the market, it is effectively removed from the contract quantity and the buyer is not required to take it at a later date.
That's interesting. Well, look, so I think the obvious last question in this round with you is, you know, what are the potential outcomes, do you think?
In our paper, we identify five potential outcomes of the notices filed by Chinese buyers and of those that are expected to be filed by Chinese buyers potentially in the future. If the sellers keep rejecting the notices, it is likely that alternative arrangements will be put in place, like cargo diversions or delays. The sellers again reject those notices, it is likely that this will lead to disputes, and some of these disputes will potentially translate into arbitrations. If the sellers accept notices, though, then the buyer will likely obtain relief, and the most desired outcome will be the suspension of deliveries. There are also some two less likely scenarios, which we'll address in the podcast, I believe, in detail, which is contract renegotiation and termination.
Right, so there are five different options which you've identified in the paper. So why don't we kind of move back to you, Mikhail, and ask the million-dollar question? You know, what do you think is going to happen next? What do you think?
Well, that brings us back to the question of what is the end game for the Chinese buyers, right? If it is relieving them of the current situation that they find themselves in, the logistical constraints and the issues that they're facing, then cargo diversions and deferrals, the suspension of deliveries is exactly what they need. Now, we have heard that some of those have been happening. Interestingly, in some of our conversations, we have heard that the buyers invoked force majeure because some of the sellers wouldn't accept deferrals.
Right.
Because the sellers weren't forthcoming in trying to find alternative arrangements. Now, it's unclear to what extent that is the case, but... And so they want short-term reprieve.
Right.
And again, these kinds of arrangements that they can come to will offer that. Suspension of deliveries, again, is good for this moment in time. But the second that there have been these force majeure notices that have been issued, the second that they are rejected, we're already in, almost arbitration territory in some form of mediation that is needed because the cargoes are on the water and somebody needs to pay for them and somebody needs to decide what happens with them. Now, there is also the possibility that the Chinese want to try and test the waters figuratively and see how willing the sellers would be to finding alternative arrangements and maybe opening up the contracts.
Well, I think really you're both identifying here a very complex picture, I think in your kind of answers. But I just keep wondering, if force majeure is a real necessity for the Chinese, or actually it's just a nice to have and they could really manage the problem themselves. What do you think?
It does seem like a nice to have, but again, we have heard it is that they had no other choice, right? They tried to defer, they tried to do other things. And it would also suggest that demand is really, really weak. You cannot take any of these volumes. Originally in early February, it was CNOOC. And then it was kind of the beginning of the outbreak and everything was in turmoil. In early March, we had PetroChina declaring force majeure on both pipeline gas and LNG.
Yeah.
So 1 month later, it could suggest that demand is extremely weak.
Yeah.
And they're running up against these logistical constraints. Most sellers would want to work with their buyers.
Yeah.
And this is where force majeure suggests that there is something else here as well.
Yeah, because it does raise a couple of questions with me, I just wonder to what extent the move could put Chinese supply energy security at risk. And also, I'm wondering whether really the Chinese companies are considering long-term implications of their force majeure actions. What do you think, Mikhail?
I think that's where they draw the line. I think that's exactly, when we're talking about them testing the waters or trying to see how far they can stretch the contract, so to speak, I think it's exactly at supply security that it ends because they won't want to reach a point where they break a commercial relationship or sort of make it unamendable. Now, of course, China is emerging as the biggest LNG buyer globally, and it's a market that everybody wants to be in.
Yeah.
But the parties are also aware, and I think their biggest concern is as much the sellers as it is their main shareholder, which is the government. So they cannot be perceived to be putting energy security at risk. I mean, interestingly, I heard, again, anecdotally, that now the government has been really upset with them invoking force majeure, not so much because of what it means for the sellers and for the markets, but because China is now trying to send a message that it's getting back to work and everything's getting better and the economy is recovering. Invoking force majeure should suggest it isn't. Yeah. And so they want to try and control the narrative.
Yeah, it's because, of course, in China, everything commercial is linked politically as well, which is certainly quite a challenging one. And, you know, long-term-wise, do you think the sellers will kind of look on China, but Chinese buyers unfavorably, as they called FM, or do you think it's just going to be business as usual?
I think it is. I think both sides see this as a negotiation. I think it was Total that were reported as saying, if we reject this, the force majeure, there's no need to reject long-term cargoes in order to buy spot cargoes. This is a negotiation. I think both sides have been working together for so long, so both buyers and sellers, that they will treat this as a negotiation and resolve it.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to pick up on that renegotiation point, if I can, with you, Agnieszka, because references all these renegotiations. You say in the paper, even though the force majeure was prompted by logistical constraints at the receiving ports, there has been growing concern in the industry that these notices are an attempt to renegotiate contracts. You know, is this the case, do you think?
Yes, as we argue in the paper, that could be potentially the case. Mm-hmm. And it is also possible that the parties will look into the contracts comprehensively, revising both price and non-price terms, like destination or volume, potentially adding some additional flexibility.
And what type of clauses do you think? You know, is it going to be flex contract volume contracts, or what other clauses could they look at, do you think?
The contracts could be shorter. The buyers could request shorter contracts. Some changes to price formulas could be introduced too in the long run. Switch to hub pricing, or at least hybrid pricing, could be requested by the buyers.
Interesting. Well, let me come back to you, Mikhail, if I may, and ask specifically about price for a few minutes. You know, what do you think? Do you think it's going to be just to bash over the head to get lower prices? And also, how successful have Chinese companies been at doing this in the past?
I mean, I think the pricing issue really is key from the domestic perspective. And we also have to bear in mind that force majeure, this is the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, perhaps. Yeah. So it feels like a bit of a nuclear option. But the concerns in the market and within China have been growing for a while, to the extent that, yes, China has its long-term contracts. And again, they are seen as sort of energy security, right? These volumes are at China's disposal.
Yeah.
But in 2019, demand growth was slower than expected after, you know, two stellar years in 2017, 2018. So all of a sudden, the Chinese market is feeling a little bit long to the buyers.
Mm-hmm.
New supplies coming in from Russia that seemed to be sort of the power of Siberia was quoted at $6 per MMBTU at the border.
Yeah.
Versus kind of landed LNG last year that averaged $8 per MMBTU, $9 per MMBTU.
Yeah.
There are pricing differentials. And finally, that China created a midstream company. There are a lot of changes happening in the domestic market. Some of the LNG import terminals are expected to be incorporated into that midstream company. Now, that then again opens the question of what are price and cost structures within China going to look like? And so there have been a number of reasons for the Chinese buyers to be unhappy with their contractual arrangements. Now, wanting to change that and perhaps get more flexibility or lower prices is one thing. But to your question, what are these alternative prices? Currently, domestic gas prices are linked to oil. They move once every year or so. There's kind of set time frame. So there isn't a great alternative. And yes, the Chinese are trying to move towards hub prices, but they don't have those yet. They know what they don't want. They don't necessarily know what they do want other than lower prices.
Exactly. It's interesting, just to refer back, you did mention liberalisation in the Chinese market, and I do urge people who are interested in that to listen to the other podcast we've recorded, which is your conclusions of the China Day, because I think we really addressed that at that particular podcast. Well, let me come back to you, Agnieszka, because you've done some research, haven't you, on past Chinese renegotiations. Perhaps can you give us some lessons from that?
Yes, indeed. I have looked into past Chinese trade negotiations, and I have to say that Chinese buyers have not been very successful in those price renegotiations in the past two decades of LNG imports. Admittedly, at the beginning, Chinese buyers had little motivation because they signed very cheap 5% slope contracts. What is more known are the price increases that have been imposed by Chinese companies along the way. For example, price review between CNOOC and BP-led Tangguh LNG increased twice the price paid by CNOOC at that time. That's the past, and the situation could be changing, and as we argue in the paper, it can be expected that Chinese buyers will get more proactive, but they are unlikely to be that aggressive as the market fears. They are required by the contracts to be good faith negotiators, and as mentioned by Michal a couple of minutes ago, they are very interested in long-term stability of supplies. So it is possible that the buyers will push hard. The outcomes remain to be seen. Some external factors are likely to play a role, like the recent fall of oil prices, and those factors can also potentially alter some dynamics of those renegotiations.
Yeah, just to let people know, we're recording this podcast on Friday the 13th of March, when oil prices are just sitting above $30 a barrel. So, yeah, that's the kind of market environment we're in. Okay, Mika, can I just come back to you on my last little question on pricing? You know, could Chinese buyers be looking to buy LNG on Chinese hub prices? You know, has the reform advanced enough for that, or do you think it's too early?
I think it's too early for that, for Chinese hub prices to be truly reflective of supply and demand dynamics within China and to reflect the price. Again, they do want to push both the Shanghai Exchange and the Chongqing Exchange, but we're still a few years away from that.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And maybe this whole kind of hiatus of demand because of the coronavirus and all the economic implications result might even slow that down further. But we wait and see. Well, look, can I come back to you, Agnieszka, again? I think I want to pick up on something you said earlier on, and that is, you know, in LNG purchases, usually the buyer and the seller negotiate in good faith and endeavour to find a solution acceptable to both parties. So I think really the crux of it is, do you think that contract termination or arbitration is a realistic possibility?
Whether arbitrations are an option, that will depend on the wording of a particular contract. And in my experience, it might be difficult to persuade a tribunal that it has jurisdiction to hear a price review claim. Whether contract terminations are possible in the long term, I would say yes. If force majeure lasts for several months, then the parties could be inclined to consider this option.
And where is arbitration? With that arbitration, that wouldn't be in China itself, would it? That would be, is it a normally London-based or Singapore or something?
Yes, you're right. That's typically a neutral seat, which will be most likely London or Singapore.
Yeah, I think that'll be...
Far from China.
But I think the only people who benefit from any sort of arbitration are the lawyers. But we won't go into that on this podcast. Mikael, I'd like to come back to you and pick up on something Agnieszka said earlier on. And when I asked her about some of the terms that could change as a result of these negotiations, and she insinuated we could see shorter contracts. So I thought my question is, do you think we're about to see the end of long-term contracts in China? What do you think?
I mean, I think it's, you know, and Agnieszka put this as well, they want the long-term commitments, long-term supply security, but not necessarily the long-term contracts. That don't give them the flexibility, again, in terms of prices or in terms of location. We are seeing China try to develop its pricing hubs. New entrants that are coming into the market, and we discussed that again in the China Day extensively, those actors typically don't have the financing and the wherewithal to engage in long-term contracts. And they will be seeking shorter-term contracts. They will be more likely to buy on a spot basis. The majors don't like that because that threatens their market share. So all these dynamics, midstream company, the changes in the demand outlook, all that suggests that the Chinese market needs more flexibility. It needs more flexibility. And at the same time, as we mentioned, we're having some price dislocations, the Russian pipeline coming in, domestic gas, imported gas, which is oil linked. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, we were at an oil link of $60 a barrel and they were at $30 per barrel. But even within the Chinese contracts, you've got the older Australian contracts, yeah. That I think initially were at $4 to $5 per MMBTU, and the initial Qatari contracts that were close to $16 per MMBTU.
Yeah, yeah.
The Chinese will want to rationalize this. The problem goes back to they will want this to be based on a domestic hub rather than a JKM. And so they will have to move ahead with their own domestic price reform, the domestic liberalization process. And until they get a clearer picture of what that looks like, they're not really in a position to do much. So the short of it is, yes, they do want something different. I think they're testing the waters now as to sellers' appetite to engage with them in this conversation, but they won't push too much.
They won't. Well, look, why don't we move on perhaps to the wider implications of this in the next part of this podcast, and as we kind of come towards the end, you know. And you suggest in the paper there could be a domino effect, as you call it, of FM discussions between buyers and sellers from other countries. You know, and I think my question is, you know, what could such a domino look like, Mikhail? What do you think? What could it look like?
Well, I think if we get force majeure especially if we get sort of force majeure being accepted by the seller, then you'll have the other buyers. The Indian buyers are typically among the more price sensitive that will, and they have been relatively aggressive in their renegotiations.
Mm-hmm.
I think those would be the first to come and say, well, let's review our pricing or our contractual terms, maybe the flexibility in those. And I think that's exactly why the sellers will not want to go down that path, at least not publicly,
to acknowledge
that.
No. And Agnieszka, do you have a view on that? I think that it's quite a critical question, isn't it, really, what the kind of the wider implications of this could be across the LNG and the gas sector. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, indeed. So it could be a mounting number of force majeure claims in the industry. And the sad reality is that the LNG industry has been been hit particularly hard by the outbreak, which originated in the key importing countries. So with the outbreak now considered a pandemic and spreading across the globe, it cannot be excluded that the operations of both buyers and sellers will be affected and potentially lead to force majeure claims and disputes across the globe and across the value chain and potentially going beyond that sector. And this is where we go back again to disputes and arbitrations.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, Mikhail, I'd like to, unfortunately, the witching hour is coming and we're getting towards the end of this podcast, but I'd like to end up with you if I can, you know, because we've covered a lot of subjects over the past 20 minutes or so. And I just really always like to end up these podcasts by asking, you know, where is he going to end up? You know, your paper says, look, over the next few years, the pressure from the Chinese government of buyers to move to more flexible contracts and prices will undoubtedly increase. So I'm just wondering, you know, how this FM situation is going to change the whole commercial relationships. Do you have a view on that?
I think it takes time. I have a sense that either within the industry or sort of academia and observers, the question is always, you know, when is the end of long-term contracts? And we tend to see that sooner rather than later. And I think there are forces, especially, again, all that we've discussed, the forces in China that are pushing towards a change.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that the change is harder and slower than we think. And I think, be it on the Chinese side, that they have a lot to figure out before they can offer a hub pricing or they can offer sort of alternative contractual structures. And globally as well, because from the seller's perspective, these contracts underpin, you know, their investments and their portfolios going forward.
Yeah.
It's not such an easy thing to break up. I mean, the arbitration, there's a procedure behind it. There's a whole sort of the legal procedure that can happen. And that will probably be where things get resolved and where these commercial relationships end up, hopefully stronger. Because the reality is that I don't know that we have something different right now. But 3-5 years down the line, I think as, you know, JKM evolves, as China starts to develop its own domestic market, it becomes more liberalized, more diversified, we get to a place where we can start looking at different contractual styles.
Well, I think that's an excellent kind of conclusion to end this disjoint podcast to. And can I, you know, thank you both very much for your time. As always, talking to you both, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Mikhail and Agnieszka's paper, Force Majeure Notices from Chinese LNG Buyers, Prelude to a Renegotiation, can be found at our website, www.oxidenergy.org, where you can also find our podcast in the multimedia folder. and other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed this truly pan-global podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.